Is the one who used to throw berries behind the Glenwood Hills Church building. And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't still do that, but if I was in another place, they wouldn't know it. And I remember the people here, usually the people who meet that time became very familiar with it. And in fact, I was thinking just last night, I remember being in a class with my brother Bennett, and we were studying the book of Acts at the time. And it was a special treat to us because imported all the way from Tampa, Florida, we had a syllabus on the book of Acts from Florida College, that college down there. And as a joke, it was now I are one. We thought it was a nice thing. And really, I'm going to have some things to say that are useful in spite of my past and in spite of my memory. I'd like to take you with me now on a personal work program. I guess many different congregations have started and ended several kinds of those things in the past. We started one in Tampa not too long ago, and whether it's the wisest thing to do or not isn't the question. There probably are better ways. Maybe after a while you learn that there really no kind of personal work is especially easy. It's going to take some hard work to get out of it. But we did decide to try to place some Bible correspondence courses in the home. That's one way to do it. So, of course, we picked the nicest neighborhood that we could. Now, we're in the vicinity of the building. Some nice people so that we wouldn't be in danger as we walk through the street. And we went to some houses that are, if I can say this in the time, very much like the ones we live in, most of us, I think. It's several cars, big cars, late model, maybe boats. In Florida, of course, that maybe means a swimming pool, maybe a third house. The reception was so poor that we almost abandoned the program after about 3 weeks. People wouldn't come to the door, they wouldn't leave their TV set, even to answer the door. And those that did, as soon as you got as far as mentioning something about Bible study, you could tell just from the look on their face they were truly listening to them, and they wouldn't miss it. You've been vacuuming to themselves, and I suppose the reception was a little better. Well, meanwhile, driving all the way to this neighborhood, which was fairly close to the building, every day, or every Sunday when we had gone out, we had passed through a trailer park, which is not the best word for it. I guess not a mobile home community or something, but that's fine. It's not as wealthy neighborhood, not as wealthy. People with one or maybe less cars. People that you would suspect have maybe some problems in their life. It's kind of a community where people come and go very quickly. And I don't mean to say that in a sad way or in a bad way. All that's just the kind of community it is. We started there giving up on the community that we had been working in. What do you think the response was? After a little practice, it seemed that maybe out of every 4 or 5 houses, you could place at least 2 or 3 correspondence courses. Now, that's not to say that they would always send them in or follow up on what they'd done, but the response was many times better than it had been in the other communities. And you get to wonder, why is it then that people that are living in places like that, maybe less educated, not nearly as secure as far as the things that this world deal with, they're not as secure in that way. And I think we do the gospel a great disservice, to say that they're not as well educated so they'll fall for anything. I think that's really a bad mistake to make that. What are the reasons? Maybe you haven't. And if it's a simple answer, you can probably be sure that it's wrong, because the answers are probably as complicated as there are different people to talk to in the world. But there are some principles, I think, that we can learn about who to approach with the gospel and how to approach them. What is it about the gospel that appeals to those kinds of people and doesn't appeal to others? And you know, this isn't a strange thing, because Jesus faced the very, very same thing. We talk about Jesus as the master teacher. And we use parables quite often to use things that are earthly, things that people face every day, to teach lessons that are spiritual in nature. But there was another purpose for those parables, and he talked about that. The truth is that often when those parables were used, it confused the people that heard them. So we wonder if the parables weren't used in some way to select one group of people over another. Turn to Matthew 13. And the big thing teaches that the same gospel will have different reception in different hearts. It's the parable of the sower that's given in this chapter. And we're not reading the parable, but you remember the story how the sower sowed in different soils and had different results in each of the four kinds of soil. We'll begin reading in verse 10. The disciples came and said to him, "Why speakest thou unto us in this parable?" And he answered and said, "Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but unto them it is not given. For whosoever hath, to him shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But whosoever hath not, from him shall be taken away, even that which he hath. Therefore speak unto them in parables, because seeing they see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand." And then he quotes the prophecy from Isaiah that said that very thing would happen when the Messiah came. People would be dull of hearing even though they heard. They wouldn't understand even though they didn't see. And then verse 16, "But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For verily I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see the things that you see and saw them not, and to hear the things that you hear and heard them not. Hear ye then the parable of the sower." And then the first verse of that explanation, "When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and understandeth it not, then comes the evil one and snatcheth away that which is that been sown in his heart. This is he that was sown by the wayside." The kind of people that Jesus was talking to didn't understand what he was. In fact, his disciples needed an explanation later on for what the parable had meant. And the first kind of soil says that some people will receive the gospel just for long enough to hear what it is about, and that's the end of it. Snatched away from their heart. The whole point of that is Jesus faced the very same thing. Funny that sometimes people he preached to were ready to hear what he said, and some others weren't. We want to look at a few examples of those, and if we can, from the study that we had this morning, draw some conclusions about, first of all, the kind of people who are likely to receive the gospel, and most importantly, why it is that they would. And if we can discover that, maybe we can change our own attitude about some things to make ourselves more susceptible to what the gospel has for us. Let's turn first to Luke 20. In Luke 20, there's a parable told, and there's an interesting parallel between the parable and real life here. So Jesus is in the presence of the chief priests and scribes and rulers. And he tells a parable, and they understand the sense that he's been speaking about them. And they, in their behavior, almost demonstrate that the truth that he has put forth in the parable are in fact, right. Look at verse 9, and we'll begin reading there. He began to speak to the people a parable. Well, we won't read the story. The story goes that a man had a vineyard, and went away into a far country, and he left the husbandman in charge of the vineyard. And you know the story that the man came time to get his harvest, and he sent to them one of his servants. He said, the master is ready for his harvest. Now the husbandman, in the midst of the garden there, they thought, let's go give it to him. Now that seems pretty unreasonable, but that's the parable. And so they beat the servant. And they did it again. Three times he sent a servant, and none of those times would they give him his rightful harvest. The husbandman who had been in charge of keeping the vineyard. And finally he says, I'll send my own son to them. They'll respect him, and I know they'll give him the harvest. So he sends his son, and what does the husbandman do to the son? Well, they kill him, actually kill him. And they reason to themselves, they say, here we are in the midst of this garden with all these treasures around us. If we don't give it to the son, we need to keep it all for ourselves. That seems like a really silly thing. That's the way they reason. I think Jesus is pointing out the absurdity of the way these people were reasoning then. Let's look at verse 16. Verse 14, but when the husbandmen saw him, they reasoned one with another, saying, this is year, let us kill him, and inheritance may be ours. And they cast him forth out of the vineyard and killed him. What therefore will the Lord of the vineyard do unto them? Verse 16, he will come and destroy these husbandmen, and will give the vineyard unto others. And when they heard it, they looked and they said, God forbid. But he said, it is written, stone which the builders rejected, the same is made the head of the corner. Everyone that falls on it shall be broken to pieces, but on whosoever it shall fall, it will scatter in the dust. And look at verse 19. The scribes and chief priests sought to lay hands on him that very hour, and they feared the people, for they perceived that he spake the parable against them. I think there's a principal thought in this parable, and I'll use this word, and maybe look at it better. We'll look at it inheritance later on. Here these husbands in the midst of the garden with the treasures of their harvest all around. And the son comes and he's going to take this away from them. Well, if they had any sense, they'd realize it would be taken away from them eventually anyway. But what Jesus is saying is, and he's talking now, remember, about the chief priests and scribes. It says that he's talking about them. They realize, how are these chief priests and scribes like the husband in the midst of something that they'd like to hold on to, temporary as it is, and because of that, rejection of the messenger sent from the Father? How are they like that? I think the answer is that here they are in the midst of their popularity and their success in the Jewish nation. And they realize, perhaps, that Jesus represents an end to that system. And his teaching really is against the things that they are in charge of. They're the leaders of. They hold a great deal in their hands in the immediate future, which they're going to lose anyway, but they maybe don't see that. The short-sightedness. And that's a contrast to back in Luke 16, verse 14, where it says, the Pharisees who were lovers of money scoffed at Jesus. The same kind of assessment. I'm trying to go over in contrast to Matthew 12, verse 37, where it says that the common people heard him gladly. So we're talking about the everyday Jew. A Jew that really doesn't have that much to hold on to in the system. They hear him gladly. The reception is more open. They're easy to accept. So we use the word poor to represent poverty now, socially, or even with financial things. We're saying that people who are perhaps poorer have left to hold on to the immediate future to be more accepted than some of these guys have said. There's a problem sometimes in personal work when you're talking with someone and you're saying, see, Jesus fulfilled this prophecy and this prophecy and this prophecy, and it becomes increasingly clear that this is the promised Messiah. And the question sometimes arises, well, if it's so obvious then, why is it that the Jews of Jesus' day rejected it? Why is it they wouldn't even accept what he had to say? And I think the answer is given in the book of John. John is a book that lists several miracles and deals with the problem of belief, with faith in the passion, reasons for concluding that Christ is the Messiah. And one of the problems that John deals with is that very thing. Here's the Jews living at the time of Christ, seeing his signs and miracles, knowing the prophecies, yet the reception is not favorable. Especially chapter 9 and 10. Let's read some from that chapter. So there's a story there that I just really like the story, because it shows people for what they really are, in all their humanity and their closed-mindedness and their prejudice. You remember the story, it begins in chapter 9. Jesus is in Jerusalem, and passed by a blind man, and his disciples asked him, he said, why is this man blind? Is it because he sinned, or is it because his parents sinned? He's born blind. And Jesus said, well, neither of those reasons, but really that I should do my work, that the Father's work should be shown. And you know that Jesus took some mud and put on his eyes and told him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam, and he did that, and he came to see. Now, this wasn't a miracle that took place in the back alley, or why was something that was hidden from the multitude? Because when he came, here's these people, and they see him, they remember this guy, he's been blind from birth. And they say, isn't this the same one? And some people thought, well, it can't be him, because he sees somebody that looks like him. And the guy said, no, it's him. They brought his parents, finally, to testify that it was really him. Well, the Pharisees heard about that. They weren't the kind of people that liked that kind of thing going on in their domain. This is the place where they really have the authority and the leadership over the Jewish people. So they bring the parents of the man in to find out if this is really the same guy that's been blind from birth. And they say that he is. And although they're a little bit afraid to go ahead and say how it was that God is fighting back, they say, why don't you just bring him in and ask him? Talk about cold, hard facts now. Here's the Pharisee bringing the actual man that was healed before them. The man who just stood there and said, I don't know how it happened, but I've been blind since I was born. He had nothing to gain himself. In fact, he was eventually thrown out of the synagogue. The man just stands there and says, I was blind when I was born, and I was until just a little bit ago, and now I see. I see just like everyone else. And they say, well, you know, how does this happen? And he says, well, I don't know. He's got to be from God or he couldn't do it. It's clear to this man that there's evidence of divinity. Faith in cold, hard facts like that, what is their reception? What is their reception? Look in chapter 9, verse 31. We'll pick up now with what the blind man has to say. We know that God hears not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and do his will, can he hear it? Since the world began, it was never heard that anyone else in the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered and said to him, thou wast altogether born in sin, and dost thou teach us, and the cast them out. To the reception, it is maybe that they didn't understand or the things weren't plain for you. And I don't think that's it at all. Jesus finds out now that he's been cast out of the synagogue. And there's an encounter with the Son of God and this blind man, in which this blind man actually finds out that this is the Son of God. And immediately he worships. But notice what Jesus said here in verse 35 on. Jesus heard that they cast him out, and finding him, he said, dost thou believe on the Son of God? He answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe on? Jesus said to him, thou hast both seen him and is he that speaketh the truth. And he said, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. Immediately said, and Jesus said, for judgment came out of this world, that they that see not may see, and they that see may become blind. Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things. You see, they begin to suspect he's talking about us again. They say, are we also blind? The Pharisees say, are we also blind then? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no shame. But now you say, we see your sin remains. We're talking about now understanding and really just opening your eyes to see the facts in front of you. Perhaps another word that would describe those who are receptive are, is the word blind. For you're blind. Saying if you're blind, then you see. But now you say, we see, and they say, remain. Okay? Another word. What does it all mean? Let's look at one other passage, and then we'll try to draw some conclusions. 1 Corinthians 1 talks about the problem of the rejection of the gospel, the preaching of Christ and being crucified by both the Jews and the Greeks. Verse 18 in chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians. For the word of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but to us who are saved is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning will I bring to naught. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For seeing that in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom knew not God. It was God's good pleasure to the foolishness of Christians to save them and believe. Okay. Seeing that the Jews ask for a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. Let's write that down. Jews were looking for signs, and I think we might add signs of power. Remember now the Jews under the Roman dominion here, hoping that the Messiah would come and deliver them from their oppression. And if he did come, we'd know him because he would come and he'd work signs and he would destroy whole Roman armies and he would just take care of us and deliver set Jerusalem up as the center of the entire world. What are the Greeks after? The Greeks seek after wisdom. Okay, but what's the answer? 23, we preach Christ crucified. Unto the Jews, a stumbling block. And unto the Greeks, we're foolish. This is what they were looking for, and this is what they found. Let's go on. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Or verse 28, but to them that are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. You see, that's what they were after, the power of God and the wisdom of God. That's what they missed. You can put that down. The wisdom of God. There's a very parallel passage in Matthew 12, which is it's really good to read at this point, because we wonder sometimes, well, says the power of God and the wisdom of God, what is that? What is that there? Were really these people presented with something that would satisfy their desire or their appetite for a sign or their appetite for wisdom? Look at Matthew 12, and you read verse 38 through 42. The servant of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, teacher, we would see a sign from thee. And he answered and said to them, an evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, And there shall no sign be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. What do you mean? For as Jonah was in the was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh shall stand up in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, a greater than Jonah is here. Now look for a sign. The sign will be given is the sign of Jonah. And what's that? Christ will die, be buried, and be raised. That's pretty magnificent power. Raised from the dead. Greater than Jonah. Let's read on. The king of the south shall rise up in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for he came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, what? A greater than Solomon is here. Okay? Greater than Solomon. So if you're looking for power, greater than Jonah, raised from the dead. If you're looking for wisdom, greater than Solomon. The Jews looked for that, but this is what they found. And this is what they missed. The Greek, the same way. They found foolishness and they missed the wisdom of God. Now let's go back to 1 Corinthians 1 and see what the result of that is in terms of who it is that the gospel reaches. Verse 26 of chapter 1. Now this is because of this, what? For behold your calling, brethren, not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. Isn't that what we're saying here? The common people here in Gladys, but not the mighty and not the noble. Read on. But God chose the foolish things of the world that he might put to shame those that are wise. And he chose the weak things of the world that he might put to shame the things that are strong, weak and wise. And the base things of the world, and the things that are despised of God, so he gave the things that are not, that he might bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory before God, that no flesh should glory before God. But of him are ye in Christ Jesus, who has made unto us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, that according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in God. So we're talking about. Poor, the blind, the foolish, and the weak. These seem to be the ones that respect the gospel most readily. Why is that? What is it about these people? And we've seen over and over that the gospel was set up in a way that it would appeal to these kinds of people. Why is it that if these two should accept the gospel? One possible answer would be, well, if a person's poor and he obeys the gospel, he suddenly becomes rich. Or, if he's blind, that is not too well educated, or foolish, you might say, he suddenly gains a great deal of wisdom. He becomes very well educated. If he's weak, he suddenly becomes very powerful and very mighty and very noble when he obeys the gospel. In other words, if you look at these people, they're all people who are in need of something. Maybe it's money or sight, or maybe it's wisdom, or maybe it's some strength of some kind. The possible answer is, are they given these things when they obey the gospel? And I don't think that's so. If you think about it, the common people that heard Jesus gladly were still common people after they heard him. And those that were foolish that were able to accept the gospel really were the same kinds of people. Not many mighty, not many noble were called. I don't think that's the answer. But I think there is something about this kind of person that makes it easier for him to accept the gospel. James 2:4 really says about the same thing that we said here about not many mighty being called. I'd like to read that, and then also remember the passage in the Beatitudes, which is, blessed is poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. James 2:4, do not make distinctions among yourselves and become judges of evil thoughts. Hearken, my beloved brethren, did not God choose them that are poor as to this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to them that love him? Those that are poor with respect to this world, does that mean they get rich in their daily life? Of course, the answer is no. What is it? Seems like these kind of people are people that recognize the need of things. We should put that as a key word. It doesn't mean that needs fulfilled when we obey the gospel. But when we begin to realize our own weakness in this world, when we begin to realize that we aren't wise enough to see the world from beginning to end, from north to south and east to west, and understand everything there is to understand. We begin to understand that life can be taken from us like that we aren't secure in anything that we have. like the man that built his barn, he said, I have need of nothing. So I've got plenty for forever. I'll just build me a big barn and hold it up there, and I'll eat, drink, and be merry. When we realize that we aren't in control of the world, that we are creatures, when we come to that realization, then we're ready to receive the gospel. What is the gospel really? What is God's message to man? Since the fall, what's man done? In his sin, he said to God, I don't care what you say. I'm going on my own free will to disobey what you said. I've taken my obedience, which I have control of, and controlled it myself as if I was setting myself up as my own creator. You remember what Romans 1 says, that professing themselves to be wise. When we begin to do that, we become fools. And what was it the people in Romans did? They worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. Where was the creature set up? The creature was set up up here. And who's eager for it to realize that I can't control this world? Any minute I'm likely to be just as poor as the next guy. And no matter how much I've learned, there's still far more than that I'll never even suspect. Who is it easier for to see that and see God is right in front of God? These people have needs in their lives. It doesn't mean that their needs are answered, but it's easy to see. And you find people that maybe have had problems in their lives and they realize that they're only finite in what they can do to solve those problems. And they're poor and they're only finite in what they can do to control their world and to build some kind of security for themselves. Maybe this is hard for us to see. I know it is for me because I haven't faced that kind of insecurity. But it's there. And the kind of people that the gospel often appeals to, what Jesus said, is people that acknowledge their need before God. They say, yes, I am the preacher. Everyone is. The question is, will we acknowledge that? Will we acknowledge that? What we're saying is, we need to think of ourselves as poor. It's very insecure. Maybe we've got to get more possessions, but certainly it's what we can do for ourselves. And blind. Not really understanding anything in the world around us without first starting with what the scriptures reveal to us in the gospel. And foolish. Really nice truth, the reason for the event for us. And we, certainly without the power of God, we are. We need to examine ourselves, and as, for instance, as we study the Bible, do we approach the Bible as a blind man, say we approach a chance to see in his life? Someone who's never seen before, do we see the truth of God as the light that comes to us after years of blindness? Something that valuable. Do we see the gospel, the truth of God, as a poor man who see a possibility of getting a certain amount of wealth? Someone who's never had enough to eat or enough to wear. If he sees the possibility of having those needs filled, that our attitude towards. We see it as the wisdom that there's no other source for. The person who's never had the sense to make the world make sense around him. The possibility of explaining some things around him. That's the value that we ought to place in the gospel. Another application of that is, when we go to people with the gospel, who is it we're approaching? We're approaching the most respectable and the most secure in his life, or we're approaching the people most likely to accept what we have to say. We sometimes turn away from those who are maybe, they're too much sinners. They live in such a low life situation. We know they'd never accept the gospel because of their past. I think we realize that we all have a past sometimes. We're all weak in that sin. We're passing people by that perhaps are the most receptive to the gospel. That's what Jesus ran into. Who are you that he fought? He got into Jerusalem, and he was in there any length of time, he's into trouble, and he's being rejected. And we go out, and if you look back at the story in John 9 and 10, completely rejected by the Pharisees in the face of cold, hard facts. Where did he go? Look at the very beginning of the next chapter. This is chapter 10. He says, he went over across the Jordan into the region where John had been baptized, and many people believed on him there. Well, you might look because John laid the foundation. But I think it's because of the kind of people that were over across the Jordan in the area of Perea. The common people. They say to themselves, and he works the same signs. He says, never before has anyone been able to work these kinds of signs. And that's what it says. Never before has anyone been able to work these kinds of times. And they accepted them readily. The different kinds of people. So the second application is, we shouldn't limit ourselves. Certainly we shouldn't limit ourselves in who we take the gospel to. But realize that those people in this world who may face more closely than we have to face sometimes, their own poverty and their own blindness and foolishness and weakness, are the ones that are most susceptible to what the gospel has to say. Because in the way they acknowledge every day that they can't control their world, that they don't have all the answers, that they are weak, that they are sinful, and that they have problems in their lives. We need to make one thing clear at this point. We're not saying that it's man's greed that created faith. That's not it at all. Because what we said that is we created that God because we need him there. And that's not the case. But it says because of our need, we can face the fact. You see, the Pharisees, the ones that they needed to believe in Jesus and the common, they didn't need to believe in Jesus and the common people needed to. They were both presented with the same facts of this blind man being healed. Why was their reception different? The facts are what our faith is based on. Our reception is our attitude. Think once again about the parable of the soul. The same seed sown. Why do different crops come forth in the world? I'm trying to say, and I'll say it again, our needs don't produce our faith. We don't create our faith from nothing. It comes from facts. The facts of prophecy. The facts of the resurrection of Christ from the dead. The facts of the testimony of many miracles we did that are written in the Bible that we can read. That's what produces our faith. What gives us the attitude of acknowledging our place before God? That is when we realize that we do have need. We'll talk a little bit more about that tonight. We want to talk about how it is that the gospel can supply some of our needs. We do accept it. So we don't make a drift right off. But there are some ways in which it does supply our needs, and some other ways in which it doesn't get answers, but still gives a great deal of comfort. As we are Christians and we have come to the point where we said, I need God and I need what the gospel has to say because I can't do it all myself. And I am a Christian and I realize that there is a creator above me. As we draw by the fact to accept that and have faith in God because of his word to us, we're drawn by the same word, we're compelled to be obedient in certain ways. And as we progress, we need to always keep in sight our own needs. Remember the church at Laodicea? What was he say there? He said, you think you're rich and he said, you think you have need of nothing. Remember that phrase in chapter 3? Church at Laodicea. Did you say, I have need of nothing? And that's a bad attitude to have. To them there. So as we grow as Christians, we need to keep sight of our own needs and realize the value of the gospel to us. Look at Matthew 11. This passage is often read as an invitation, but I'd like to back up a couple of verses and tie in the invitation that Christ gives with the principles that we've talked about today. Matthew 11, verse 25. At that season, Jesus answered and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven, that thou didst hide these things from the wise and understanding, and didst reveal them unto babes. They're hidden from the wise and understanding. They're revealed to babes. Think about babies. And I'll see several going in and out the doors. They have needs all the time, constantly. Just constantly need of care for years after their life. Yea, Father, for so it was well pleasing in our sight. Verse 27. All things have been delivered unto me and my Father, and no one knows the Son save the Father, neither doth any know the Father save the Son. And he whosoever the Son will to reveal him. In verse 28 is what we often read, and I think that in terms of those who have needs in this world. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your soul, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This morning we want an offer invitation for someone who hasn't acknowledged their place as the creature before the Creator. We're all in that place. The point of the gospel is to make us acknowledge that. voluntarily obey the commands we give you this day. When all these things take place, someone who needs to obey the gospel this morning, or anyone who needs to do something in a public way, we encourage you to comment and stand.